It's summer, time to read on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Today we'll talk about some books for vacation reading on Scribble. Is there really a difference between vacation reading and other reading?
I'm a bad person to ask because I taught school, so my summer was quite different as far as reading was concerned. For me, summer was a time to get to read the books that I didn't have to teach but have always wanted to read, or to read books that were longer than I had time to read during the school year.
Well, now the cliche is you get books to read on the beach. Does that make sense?
Have you ever tried to read a book on a beach?
No, I'm not crazy.
There is no hotter place on earth than a beach when the sun is beating down. And to imagine sitting under an umbrella trying to read in that heat. People apparently do it. I mean, I see it in cartoons all the time, but I don't think I've ever saw a person on a beach actually reading.
But is a cartoon really a depiction of real life?
What they mean is light, fluffy reading, mm-hmm. right? Reading that you can read, a book you can pick up, read in 7 hours and toss away.
Yeah.
And to me, that is not a good use of time. There are so many good books out. And besides which, there are people that love summer vacations in which for their 2 weeks or 4 weeks, they just sort of vegetate. Mm-hmm. And I felt that way for a week or so after I taught school. I mean, I was just wiped out and I would just loaf for a week. But then I wanted to do something or I wanted to go someplace. I prefer that kind of vacation where you set yourself a task that might be more difficult, like hiking the Inca Trail to Machu Picchu, for instance, instead of just sitting around on a beach. And I think reading is the same thing. You can read light reading, but also to me it would make more sense and it would be more memorable and it would do you better to set yourself a project of some kind. Mm-hmm. Here's what I'm going to do during these 2 weeks that I have or during the summer that I have.
Well, the first 12 years I worked in Rock Island, I never took a vacation. So I didn't exactly know how to approach the idea of one.
Right.
But, the whole business of taking a vacation and reading, I remember one terrifying summer when I read all of Dostoevsky. I mean,
right.
That's, I don't know. I wouldn't recommend it.
No, but you remember it.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I remember it. I remember thinking, he's having trouble depicting a good person.
Right.
I mean, he's very good at Raskolnikov and guys like that.
Right.
But it isn't until he gets to the brothers Karamazov that he is able to depict one of the brothers as good, Alyosha.
Right.
And then, of course, it has that legend of the Grand Inquisitor, which is just one of the most significant chapters in fiction I've ever read. So it was interesting, but boy, those are big, thick books. Fortunately, there were good, Constance Gardner, I think was the name of the translator, something like that. They were good translations.
But you could do a lot worse than go back and reread The Brothers Karamazov or Moby Dick or another, War and Peace. Because you'll never forget that you did that particular summer.
Yeah, that's true. But, the thing that struck me when I knew we were going to read, we're going to talk about summer reading, I walked past this list of books and suddenly saw A Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole. And I thought, wow, I remember that book, and I'm reading it again, right. halfway through it. But the thing that, one of the things about the book, if you've never read this, it's an old book, but it was Walker Percy was badgered by a woman who wanted him to read a novel by her son,
right.
who had committed suicide. Right. So he finally agreed reluctantly, and his rule was right. the minute it's boring, he closes it. But the more he read, the more he liked it. He found a publisher for it, won a Pulitzer Prize.
Right.
And it's true, there's nobody quite like Ignatius J. Reilly, the hero. And the characters that you run into in New Orleans, if you've not read that book, let me recommend it to you, whether you're on vacation or not, A Confederacy of Dunces. And it's in paperback, I'm sure, so you'll save a little money.
I did come across a couple of books that I think would both qualify for, you know, what the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal call summer reading, very light reading, easy to read, but at the same time are really very informative and very interesting books. So let me do those at this time. The first is called The Ghost Orchard by Helen Humphreys, H-U-M-P-H-R-E-Y-S. She's Canadian. And this book began one day when she was eating an apple called the White Winter Pearmain. Never heard of it. But it's called Pearmain because it has a over flavor of pear. White Winter Pearmain. And she got to wondering, how did this apple get here? And so she starts looking at the history of apples and discovers how they got to the New World, when they got to the New World. They weren't native to North America. And so you get a sort of history of how apples came to be, how they spread, what kind of a orchard George Washington had, and so forth. And that really turns out to be an interesting story. It includes, of course, Johnny Appleseed, whose real name was Chapman, and who, in fact, didn't do this out of the goodness of his heart. He went around planting seeds, and seeds will only produce cider apples because they'll never produce true to type, because he wanted to set up cider presses all across the country, right? I mean, you know, he wasn't doing this just as a folk hero. But there was a woman, Quaker, who was a traveling Quaker minister who did go from place to place throughout most of the United States, taking with her plants of apple trees. And she's responsible for the spread of incredible numbers of apple orchards throughout New England and even throughout the South. I mean, she's the real folk hero of this whole thing. It turns out at the height of the apple rage, there were 17,500 varieties of apples in the United States.
Wow.
Because anybody, you know, growing a seed can produce a new kind of apple. The other thing that I hadn't even thought about is that it was a godsend for the Native Americans because it was a fruit that it could harvest at different times, starting in July all the way till November, depending on the variety, and it would keep all winter mm-hmm. without refrigeration and without, you know, and so there are incredible numbers of Native American orchards. These are the ghost orchards that she's referring to in the title. There are still remnants left of Indian orchards because all the Indians had huge, extensive orchards of apples. Anyway, she talks about that, but not in technical terms, it's not deep history. This is just an interesting story. She has a friend who has MS and who, as a way of exercising with that friend, goes around to various apple orchards, travels around and does research for this project. And then she has the middle third of the book is on Robert Frost and his love of apples after apple picking, how many poems he had about apples, but also the orchards that Robert Frost grew himself. And then the last of it is a kind of memoir of she and her friends' travels and stuff. So it's just a very pleasant read, but boy, do you learn a lot about apples.
And that's The Ghost Apple?
The Ghost Orchard, it's called.
Ghost Orchard.
By Helen Humphreys.
Oh, my. It reminds me The new book on pioneers mentions Chapman. He went through Ohio along with all those other people. And that's a new book that's really very interesting. McCullough doesn't know how to write a dull history book.
No, he doesn't.
And this is not one of his great ones, but it's a chapter of American history that is turns out to be quite interesting because the Northwest Ordinance sets up this area of the country that's going to be free of slavery, and they're going to build schools here, by golly. And what eventuated from that, it's full of colorful characters from Aaron Burr and Chapman to people that you've never heard of before but turn out to be crucial to the development of the state of Ohio. The Pioneers, that's by McCullough, and that's a book we've talked about before. Let me just, before I give it back to you for a book, I finally got hold of a copy of Mary Oliver's Why I Wake Early. That's a book of poetry you talked about.
Hello, Sun in My Face.
Yeah, and I want to read that. And the person who lent it to me said, you should know that 10 of her volumes are together now in one book called Devotion. So there's a bargain for you. You can pick up a book called Devotion, contains 10 volumes of poetry by Mary Oliver. And Mary Oliver, you know, they're poets I like. Phyllis McGinley will always be my favorite, Elizabeth Bishop, Billy Collins, Seamus Heaney, Larrikin, Auden, Eliot. Those are, of course, Shakespeare beats them all, but these are relatively new. Edna St. Vincent Millay and Dorothy Parker will be with me to the end.
Right.
But, you know, if you like Mary Oliver, and there's no reason why you shouldn't, be aware that you can get a collection of all 10 volumes under the title of Devotion. So there's my money-saving tip for you for your summer reading, and you can dip into that poetry book the rest of the year.
It will put you on an emotional vacation, Mary Oliver will.
Wow. Yeah. It's there's a sweetness along with a depth to her work that is just beautiful. Yeah, I like her very much. And I don't talk a lot about poetry, but I do read it.
And you write it.
Oh, I write. You scoundrel. You're responsible for me writing poetry because you said you were going to write poetry.
I've written it. I just haven't.
Yeah, but you don't show up at Quin City Poets.
I know. I don't.
First Wednesday of the month, the Bettendorf Public Library, 6:30. Put your dollar on the table and read your poem. Okay, what else is in your book bag today?
You know, I never thought when we started this program 4.5 years ago that I would ever be recommending a graphic novel.
That is a surprise.
I as an English teacher, I'm obligated not to recommend graphic novels. But this one, sent to me by Nan Carter, our San Francisco contact, It just blows your mind. And if you are looking for a kind of gift to trying to get a teenager to read, I would go ahead and get a copy of this book. The name of it is Aya, A-Y-A.
A-Y-A.
That's the name of a teenage girl in the graphic novel. The name of the author is, she's Ivory Coast writer, Margarita Aubriere, O-U-B-R-I-E-R-E, Aubriere, I think it is. And it takes place in the major city in the Ivory Coast. And it deals with three or four girls who are friends in school and who are thinking about boys, thinking about their futures. I mean, the things that teenage girls do. But you know, when you think of Africa, you think of mud huts, you know, and war and
jungle
and snakes and genocide and stuff like that. In the same way, and when I go to South America with a student group, and the minute I say I'm from Illinois, and they say, "Well, where?" and I say near Chicago, I did not have a single person not say, bang, 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 right? As if Chicago is the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. I mean, it's just unbelievable. But we have the same myths about Africa. In this book, in the Ivory Coast, the girls live in a working class neighborhood, and it contains, small brick homes where they live. But also in the distance, there are high rises, there are skyscrapers, there are four-lane highways, there are cars speeding by. The teenage girls are dressed and worry about dress in much the same way our teenage girls worry about dress here. Aside from a few little things like that, you wouldn't know that you were in an African city. It is a whole different view of Africa that's just as real. You know, the killings in Somalia are real.
Yeah.
But also so are these teenage girls who are, it could be downtown Rock Island or downtown Davenport.
Mm-hmm.
And they could be teenagers going to Central.
So Aya, A-Y-A?
A-Y-A is the name of the primary girl whose dad works for a beer company. And it is mind-blowing. And it's easy to read. I mean, it's a graphic novel. It's long. But I think, I have looked at graphic novels before, but this is the first one I've really read through, and it does a very good job
of
portraying a whole different, taking care of some of the illusions that you have about what Africa really is.
Okay, chalk one up for graphic novels, but, I know I've talked about this before briefly, and as a matter of fact, once I read it, I couldn't stop talking about it. Aristotle's Way, How Ancient Wisdom Can Change Your Life by Edith Hall. Edith Hall is a classic scholar, and what she has done is gone back to Aristotle and put together in chapters some of his ideas about happiness, human potential, how you make decisions, how we communicate, achieving self-knowledge, your intentions, love, community, leisure, and mortality. This is one of the most accessible books I've ever read on philosophy. It takes me back to when I was in college and first discovered philosophy. I didn't know there was such a thing. I'd heard the word, but I didn't know what it meant. And we went through, start with Thales, Anaximander, Anaximenes, and all the way up Pythagoras to the big boys, Plato and Aristotle, after Socrates. And, of course, I was in the seminary, so we got Aquinas' version of Aristotle. It was fascinating, but that was then. That was, 70 years ago. Now, going back to Aristotle, I must say, he must have been the wisest man who ever lived. And what a beautifully contained mind, and how very human he is. It is just, I found it quite moving to read this book on what he has to say, particularly about a subject like equity. This came up when I was in the Illinois legislature, and they were wanting to pass bills on mandatory sentences. And I thought, you can't do that because there are extenuating circumstances. You can't just say that you do this, you get this. That's why we have judges. There's no equity in that kind of justice. And he deals with that beautifully in this. But the last chapter on mortality, at the age of 90, I found this very moving to read. It is easy to understand, and when you read this book, you really, it says How Ancient Wisdom Can Change Your Life. It's called Aristotle's Way by Edith Hall. And I recommend it to you, regardless of where you stand on philosophy or anything else. I think you will get something out of this, something rich and deep and moving.
That sounds like not a beach read.
No, it's not a beach read. I settled in my recliner and read this and just
right.
I glowed all the way through. I loved it, every minute of it. And I realize I can be a little heavy on some of these things, but this, I think you will agree, if you read Aristotle's Way, you start into this, you'll go all the way to the end, because it has something to tell
That's
you.
That's a mark of a good book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. So, put my stamp of approval on that. Your turn.
Well, I'm back to nature again. A couple of years ago, I read a book by a German writer named Peter Wohlleben, who's the manager of one of the large forests in Germany, called The Hidden Life of Trees, in which he talks about the way in which trees can think and,
oh, yeah,
and respond to enemies.
That's, by the way, a book people should read.
Well, not only should you read that, but you should read his last book, which is the end of a trilogy, of which The Hidden Life of Trees is one. This one is called, it's just out, The Secret Wisdom of Nature.
The Secret
and
Wisdom
the secret
of Nature.
Wisdom of Nature. And wisdom is a carefully chosen word there. It's eminently readable. Again, it's not terribly technical. But the theme is, like many books on nature these days, the interconnectedness of all of nature. For instance, the health of worms in Poland depends on how many pigs there are going to be by a roundabout kind of way. And we all know that nature, more and more we realize that everything is connected, and you take one little part away, you're going to screw the whole thing up. But what is unusual about this book, and this is why I think he calls it wisdom, is that he goes even further and suggests in this book that you know, who is it, Dawkins that wrote The Selfish Gene? What life wants to do is reproduce itself at all costs, pushing everybody out of the way. He suggests, however, that this great web of nature cares for each other, and that trees, for instance, when a drought is coming, they are so concerned about the other trees in the forest, not only their own saplings that are coming up, but other trees, that they will reduce the amount of leaves they have to prevent them from using water, and they'll cut way back on their nutrients and make sure the nutrients get out. Or, for instance, the long example is there's a tree that woodpeckers love to use, except the wood is so hard that the woodpecker's beak is not ready to do that. So the brown bark beetle comes in and for a year or so burrows beneath the bark into the trees, and somehow softens the wood enough for a year later the woodpeckers come in and now they can make a hole. Okay, over about 3 years the woodpeckers enlarge their hole to the point where it's too big for the woodpeckers to use because the fledglings can't get out of it, but it's perfect for owls. And so the owls in year four move in. And the owls stay there about 3 years, and they keep adding matting and stuff to make nests. And that, 7 years later, prepares for a certain insect who only can use that environment to live in.
Yeah. It is amazing how nature, you know, we're all bound together, and why human beings continue to insist that we are apart from it, superior to it and everything. You think, don't you look around? Can't you see? We are connected deeply with nature.
And I'm still trying to wrap my mind around whether nature cares for each other or not, but they work together in incredible ways. So chapter after chapter deals with the ways in which this little bug wouldn't exist if this, you know, didn't live, and this didn't live, and this didn't live. And they're interconnected, not directly even. You know, the bark beetle comes in, makes room for the woodpecker, who makes room for the owl, who makes room for the last little insect to use the tree.
Yeah. Well, I want to steer you to the kind of light reading that the summer is supposed to be, but in the area of mysteries and detective stories, I want to give you three names of authors to look at. Andrea Camilleri, Andrea C.A., and then Miller, I. Camilleri, and Peter Robinson, and Ross MacDonald. I've read a lot of mysteries in my time, But I found the series that these three have written are just fascinating. Andrea Camilleri's first book is called The Shape of Water. His latest book is The Other End of the Line, and I don't know how many books there are in between. And he has the most fascinating group of funny Italians in Sicily, funny and serious all together. It starts out a little slow, but the series just gains strength as it rolls.
That's with Brunetti, right, as the detective?
No, this is with, Salvo, can't think of his last name, Brunetti.
Oh,
that's the Venetian.
That's Donna Leon.
Yeah, Donna Leon, that's another good series.
Another good one to ask. Yep.
Peter Robinson writes about Inspector Alan Banks. His first book, and you should start with that, is Gallows View, and his latest is Many Rivers to Cross. There are a ton of books in between. And then the best of the hard-boiled detective school of Southern California is Ross McDonald, who's been gone for many years now. He wrote about 17 or 18 books. The first one is The Moving Target, and the last one is The Blue Hammer. And as you go through this series of books, it deepens. The characters mean more. The stories become more verging on literature rather than entertainment. And Ross McDonald I greatly admired. But those three guys, and Donna De Leon, let's add her too, if you want to read detective stories, start with the first one, Shape of Water by Camilleri, Gallows View by Peter Robinson, The Moving Target by Ross McDonald. And that's my contribution to detective literature. But are you out of books?
No, I'm not out of books yet, but I don't...
We have just a few minutes left.
Okay, well, let me suggest, you know, I do like the idea, as I was thinking about this program, of setting yourself for the summer a project, like you plan a vacation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the projects could be reading a genre you've dismissed before or never thought you would like. For instance, science fiction. There are people that love science fiction, but also people that wouldn't touch it. But there is science fiction that's worth reading. Westerns the same way, right? And mystery stories, of which you've just given some examples. Or go back and read a book that you got really hooked on back in school. I did a year ago or so, I think, go back and read Catcher in the Rye, which I was really hooked on.
Yeah, that and To Kill a Mockingbird are worth reading again.
But I don't think Catcher in the Rye is going to hold up. To Kill a Mockingbird does.
Oh, yeah.
You might be surprised at how you have changed.
That's
true. If you go back and look at a book that you read.
That's true. Catcher in the Rye, I'll admit, will not hold up as well, but To Kill a Mockingbird will
always...
That's
going to hold up for a long time.
Yeah, that is a book that'll be relevant for all time, and those are the kind of books you should read, but actually, you know, I'm almost like the desperate grade school teacher. You should read just about anything you want. Just keep reading.
That's right.
And we'll keep talking about it, too. I'm Don Wooten with Rural Tweet. Thank you for attending our rambling business on summer reading. We'll be back to more standard fare next week with another scribble.